Hi, and welcome to the Homeopathy Health Show. I'm Atik Amadbhati, a fourth-generation homeopath with over 20 years of professional experience in this field of healing. In the Homeopathy Health Show, I'll be talking all things homeopathy and natural, with guest interviews, tips and advice, and answering some of your questions. Homeopathy is truly a unique, complementary system of healing suitable for all ages, young and old. I'd love to hear from you and welcome your questions on homeopathy and how it can or has helped you. Feel free to email me at health@liketreatslike.co.uk or visit www.liketreatslike.co.uk for more information. Whilst you're there, take a look at the Knowledge Academy and blog section, where you will find interesting information. Both sections are growing day by day, so always check back. So let's begin today's show on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio, real feel-good radio. Hi, how are you? I do hope you and your loved ones are well. So nice to have you back again this week on the Homeopathy Health Show. Now, in today's show, I'll be answering some of your questions received on how homeopathy can help with issues of insomnia, cramps, and nosebleeds. In the natural health segment, I'll be speaking with Deborah Campbell, who's actually a local beekeeper based in Buckinghamshire in the UK. I'll be asking her to detail what is involved in beekeeping and the production of pure, rich honey from hive to jar. And of course, my regular Time for Reflection segment will feature another timely poem on healing. So in today's show, I'd like to start off actually the first half of the show at least on answering some of the many questions that I've received. So thank you for sending them through, and keep sending them through. It's great, because answering questions can make homeopathy very tailored and specific as such. First question is that I've been suffering from insomnia for a few months. Is there any homeopathic medicine that can help me? Well, yes, the answer is a resounding yes. However, if we first look at what insomnia is, that will actually help as far as the understanding of what this condition is. Now, the Mayo Clinic says that insomnia is a common sleep disorder that can make it hard to fall asleep, hard to stay asleep, or cause you to wake up too early and not be able to get back to sleep. You may still feel tired when you wake up. Insomnia can sap not only your energy level and mood, but also your health, work performance, and quality of life. Well, that's actually very sensible anyway. That's just common sense here, isn't it? Because if you find that you're not sleeping well, then of course you're going to be very, very tired. Sleep is a natural phenomena that we all have to adhere to religiously, I would say, because without sleep we cannot actually function. Which does take me off on one of my tangents. You're probably thinking, oh no, which one? But if we reflect and ponder over this, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we think we are invincible, and certainly we can do incredible feats physically and with our mind, and we can achieve greatness. But if we cannot sleep for more than 24 or 48 hours, it's terrible, isn't it? Because the body is just unable to carry on. So this is something to always reflect upon, the importance of sleep, but also the fragility of life, I guess, is where my tangent is heading. The sheer fragility of life itself, that, you know, we are so capable, human beings are so capable. They've been blessed with so much capability and progress. But at the same time, there's frailty there, because without a regular sleep pattern, we can, you know, it's almost like a self-destruct mode, because after a few days without sleep, you're going to black out anyway and collapse. It's just not possible to stay awake for any extended period of time. Such is the human body, that it needs to repair damage to tissues, organs. It needs to heal as you sleep. The brain needs to rest. The mind needs to rest. The mind needs to switch off. Now, in answer to your question, there is not one specific homeopathic remedy as such to treat insomnia, because the causes, as far as I'm concerned, my personal experience has shown that insomnia is, again, a symptom and it's a side effect. So we must understand that first. That's very, very important. Insomnia is not... insomnia is a condition. It is a disease or dis-ease. It's an ailment, whatever it is you want to call it as such. But it's a byproduct. It's the cause is actually something else. Now, generally, from my experience, I find that those suffering from insomnia, let's split this into three, shall we? So those suffering from insomnia generally have one of three issues, or have gone through one of three issues. Now, the first one, which is very, very common, sadly, I say, is trauma, grief, and being overwhelmed. So trauma can be personal trauma, it can be trauma that you've witnessed, it can be trauma that you've encountered or a friend has encountered, and that makes the mind go into this state of imbalance, and that restlessness starts to begin within the body itself. Remember, the mind is a very, very powerful force. We're not talking about the physical matter. We're not talking about brains, the brain itself. We're talking about the mind. So the age-old saying, isn't it? If you think you're ill, or you think long enough or hard enough or repeatedly enough that you're ill, or you're going to get sick, or you're going to get sick, you actually do end up getting sick, because the mind can control, of course it can. The mind controls the brain. The brain, of course, then sends the wrong signals, in this case, to the body. Now, trauma and grief are very, very big keys nowadays, I find, when I see patients that they do suffer from some sort of trauma. Once you've discussed the case with them and you've discussed their condition, or there's some sort of unresolved grief. In fact, I forgot to mention shock. Being overwhelmed can also be a byproduct of the initial shock. So trauma itself can lead to shock, and then shock can lead to many, many other spin-off ailments or symptoms as such. Now, number two is very much to do with anxiety. Now, this is not the anxiety as a follow-up from trauma. It's for individuals who haven't had that type of trauma, but they're thinking, well, you know, recently I've started to feel very anxious. Now, I tell you something interesting, and this is not the de facto statement, because there's so many different possibilities here. I'm just going on giving you a few examples just to sort of get an idea of some of the causes. But anxiety, I have treated so many and continue to treat so many patients who started suffering from anxiety purely because they are overworked, as in there's too much for them to do, and they become very overwhelmed. And when you become overwhelmed, your body sometimes does not know how to handle itself and control. And as a result of that, anxiety starts to come and attack the body as such. So if you have too much to do at work, and you go into work, and you know, you've been going through it for months or months at a time, or you've just started a job and you feel, oh my God, within the first 2 weeks, I'm working 12-hour days, the body can become overwhelmed, and that leads to anxiety. So, and that anxiety actually affects the mind, because the mind is then worrying, it's full of anxiety, and it prevents you from sleeping. It's like a ticker, isn't it? It just keeps ticking along, that I've got to do this, or how will I manage this, or I've got this to do and that to do and that to do, and I've only got so many hours to do it in, and these are the deadlines. So that's another area to look at as well, as far as insomnia is concerned. And the third one is the sort of the slightly more complex one, which is to do with insomnia as a result of medications that you're on, perhaps, or the diseases that you have or are suffering from at that moment in time. And they can sometimes just change the sort of chemistry and affect your sleep pattern as such. So again, this is just based on my personal experience, and this is just a very light example as such. I can talk about it for hours, to be honest, but let's give you some guiding remedies. Now, remember that insomnia is different from sleeplessness. Sleeplessness is usually acute, and again, even though it may be caused by traumatic events or being overwhelmed or anxious or perhaps medications, but generally sleeplessness is short-lived as such. So here we're talking about insomnia, which is just not able to get to sleep at all. And when you do get to sleep, after about 10 minutes, or certainly after half an hour or an hour, you wake up again and you're thinking, oh, and you're fully awake, and it's difficult then to have to think about, or forcing yourself to, or think about having to go back to sleep. So the first thing is to identify, of course, the cause of the insomnia. This is very, very important. And by going to see a qualified registered homeopathic practitioner, you can discuss your condition in detail. So this is very, very important to understand, because like I've just explained, there can be several causative factors. But for your information, there are some homeopathic remedies that you can try whilst you're waiting to see a homeopath to get to the root cause, of course, which should help. Certainly they'll help to calm the nervous system, remove any undue, highly strung harmonics within your system itself, and they should help. Now, there are four remedies. The first one is coffea. The second one is Daphne indica. There's a third one, which is Kalaifos. And then one which I'm quite sure you will know of is Passiflora. Now, I use Passiflora quite a lot, actually, in the clinic itself. So it's one of my go-to for any type of sleep or insomnia issues to help treat. Passiflora is generally taken, and this is the passion flower, and the tincture is prepared from the passion flower itself. The tincture is taken as, for example, 10 drops 1 hour before bed in some warm water, or water actually that is room temperature, let's say, rather than warm, because then that might be, and you might may come under the impression that I'm saying to boil it. Certainly not, just a room temperature water. So say a quarter glass of water and 10 drops of Passiflora 1 hour before your bedtime, and this can be repeated again, so 30 minutes before your bedtime. So you would actually have two doses within that hour. So if you were to go to bed at 10 o'clock, you would take 10 drops in a quarter glass of water at 9 p.m. And then you would repeat that again at 9:30 p.m. Kalaifos is a very good nerve remedy. It's, of course, one of the Suchler tissue salts, the biochemic tissue salts, which is generally taken in a 3x or a 6x or 12x potency. But I'm talking about the homeopathic version, and this would be taken in a potency of 6C, and this is Kalaifos. And this remedy works to quieten the nervous system and can help. If the nervous system is quiet, it can help induce sleep. Now, Kalaifos would be taken in this case for 90 minutes before bed. So if you are going to sleep, let's say your bedtime is 10 p.m., then you would start Kalaifos. You'd take one dose at 8:30 p.m. You'd repeat it after half an hour at 9 p.m. Then you'd repeat it again for a third time after half an hour, which is 9:30 p.m. And then, of course, you'd go to bed at 10 p.m. And that needs to be done for a few days, of course. But that's, I've generally found from experience, it takes a few days. Daphne indica is a remedy that's used in homeopathy for the complete inability to sleep. So again, it's quite useful actually for insomnia here. especially Passiflora and Daphne Indica. So both are key indicated remedies. And the last one is coffea. Now, can you guess what coffea is? Well, coffea is actually coffea cruda, which is unroasted coffee. And it's a very effective remedy for a number of things, which include excitement, hyperactivity, sleeplessness, and of course the subject matter here for this answer to the question, it's very useful for insomnia. So again, coffea can be taken in a 30C potency, and this would be taken at the 90-minute stage, so 1.5 hours before bed, and then keep repeating for 2 further doses at 30-minute intervals. And these are the 4 remedies, but I would strongly say that for insomnia, you should go and see a homeopath, because you need to get to the root cause. And I can certainly say that, and from experience as well, that there is very effective treatment in homeopathy to overcome insomnia. And it just means just giving a bit more information than perhaps you want to. But the more information you give a homeopath, the easier it becomes for them to pinpoint the ideal remedy to get rid of that condition.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
So back to the questions. Now, the second question is that someone has asked, I keep suffering from cramps in the back of my calves. What's the best homeopathic remedy to take? For cramps in the calves, the remedy that I always go to and use is a remedy called Calcarea carbonica, or Calcarea carb as it's generally referred to. Now, Calcarea carb is actually made from calcium carbonate. It's a remedy that's very, very useful for a number of issues, and these include mental, emotional issues. They include malnutrition, abscesses, bone diseases, arthritis, dentition, very good for teething pains in infants at the age of teething, or the few months when they start teething in the early months. And it's good for joint disorders generally. It's really good, by the way, for nightmares in children. So sometimes children have nightmares and they say, oh, there was a monster in my dream, or someone was chasing me. It's very, very effective to help treat that condition. And it's actually just as useful in adults who may have those dreams as well. And it's very, very effective, as I said, for cramps in the calves. Now, sometimes a detailed case is taken in homeopathy, especially when there is a mental and emotional link. But sometimes I just refer to quick remedies, which I know will do the trick, and they work like with like, as such, like treats like, and they will work to fix and rectify the problem. So Calcarea carb is a very effective remedy for cramps in the calves. As far as the potency of the remedy Calc carb is concerned for cramps in the calves, Generally, a 200C once a day for a few days is more than sufficient to resolve the condition. Sometimes one dose is sufficient. It may take three, it may take five. But taken once a day, possibly in the morning or in the evening, and hopefully, fingers crossed, everything should work out very well. Now, also bear in mind that sometimes cramps in the calf also mean a disturbance in circulation, especially if you suffer from pins and needles. So again, calc carb can help with that, but certainly there are other remedies available for resolving any issues with circulation. As long as you do not have blood pressure or any heart condition, always be sure you know the ailments that you have and that you manage with medicine from the doctor. It's important to also have regular checks, of course, for your health is concerned. But circulation can also be resolved through homeopathy. Sometimes it's just one of those things, and it just homeopathy comes in like it's almost like a magic bullet, and it just fixes the condition, and it's fine. And I've seen so many cases like that, where people have circulation issues, pins and needles. They said, oh, I've got cramps in my calves, and feel a bit lethargic. Give them a few doses of calcarea carb, and fine and dandy, as right as rain, as such, you know. So that's something to bear in mind. And the last question for today is, my child keeps suffering from nosebleeds. What shall we do? Well, the first thing is always make sure, especially where children are concerned, that they're hydrated. So they're drinking sufficient amounts of water to keep them hydrated. Secondly, you know, I have found personally with children that I treat that sometimes eating too many chocolate bars, delicious as they are, of course, can cause, because cocoa, the cocoa bean, has, it's called a hot constitution. Now, generally, people from South Asia will understand that. In Urdu, for example, they call it garam, which means hot. So some foods are hot, and this is not hot as in chili powder. This is the constitution of that ingredient. So chocolate, the cocoa bean, is a hot constitution. The coffee bean also fits under this. Beef, for example, beef has a hot constitution. Trotters, which are quite favorably eaten in some parts of the world, have a very, very hot constitution. Cinnamon has a hot constitution. So, you know, it's always something to bear in mind, that, isn't it? So the point is, just bear in mind, firstly, what the child is eating, and it should be a balanced diet, of course. Now, the remedy, the chief remedy that I always use for nosebleeds is the remedy Millifolium, and I give that in a potency of 1 mL, generally three doses, which are half an hour apart, and I find that the nosebleeds don't ever come back. If it is a profuse nosebleed that's just happened and someone is asking you that, oh, look, I've got a homeopathic kit and what's the remedies that I should take to stop the nosebleed, then, of course, the first thing is make sure you tilt the head back and put a cold flannel at the root of the nose. But Millifolium at that time can be given in a 1 mL, one dose, wait 15 minutes, repeat one dose, wait 15 minutes, repeat one dose. Generally, one to two doses, to be honest with you, works really, really well, and the nosebleeds stop. And I don't think I've ever put, this is my personal experience, I've never had someone who's come back saying, oh, the nosebleeds started again. They only ever needs to be taken once or twice or thrice, but as in on one occasion to treat nosebleeds. So I do hope that helps answer your question, and it gives you some sort of guidance and knowledge as far as nosebleeds are concerned. Hi, this is Atik from the Homeopathy Health Show. I'm here to help and support you in your health and wellness journey, to answer your questions on everything homeopathy and much more. To get in touch, contact me via my email, health@liketreatslike.co.uk, or visit online at www.liketreatslike.co.uk. You can also find me on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram by searching for Like Treats Like. Or just visit UK Health Radio online and you'll find my contact information under the Presenters tab. Homeopathy is a wonderful natural complementary system of healing, so let's work together for your health, wellness and vitality. Now we move to the natural health part of today's show. Now, over the last several episodes, I've had the good fortune to speak to a number of experts in all things honey and propolis, and we've looked at the benefits of propolis as an immune support medicine and its healing capabilities. And we've also discussed the benefits of honey in reducing cardiometabolic risks. Now, today I'm delighted to be joined by Deborah Campbell, who is a beekeeper based in the southeast of England. So firstly, Deborah, thank you very much for coming on the show today. I hope you're well. And before I forget, I must see you to pick up my next batch of pure honey.
That's lovely. Yes. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you here. So can you give us an introduction to yourself, really? You are a beekeeper. I know that much. And I know that I regularly do visit you.
Yeah.
To purchase local pure honey, hive to jar honey as such. So if you can give us a quick introduction on yourself.
Just a little bit about me then. Well, I've been beekeeping for about 15 years, and I'm a hobbyist beekeeper. So I've only got a few colonies. Currently, I've got 10 colonies, 10 hives. And this may sound a lot, but it's actually nothing compared to the bee farmers who have hundreds, if not thousands, of colonies in various parts of the country. So it's a very modest concern that I have. But I do sell and also gift my honey. And so I have to adhere to the same legal requirements, food handling and storage, etc., that bee farmers do, because my honey is part of the food chain.
Okay.
So whilst beekeeping, I've taken and passed both practical husbandry exams and more academic module exams, and I'm now a master beekeeper. I mentor beginner beekeepers and run module groups, as well as examining at beginner and intermediate husbandry levels. My husband is allergic to being stung, and so I don't keep these bees in my apiary.
I certainly hope you don't. Yes,
I have an out apiary.
All right.
My God, that's big enough to accommodate them.
Excellent. So, a master beekeeper. So, congratulations, of course.
Thank you.
That sounds really good. You know, it sounds very, very master beekeeper. But what's involved actually in that is, do you get a lot of inquiries, for example, of people who wish to start up within beekeeping itself?
Well, most beekeepers get lots of inquiries about people wanting to start up. It's a very, very popular hobby. And we try and explain what's involved and the time and financial commitment that is involved. It's not cheap setting up as a beekeeper.
Okay. Now, the question that I've always wanted to ask you and never had the time, and I always get asked, why did I become a homeopath? So you can guess the question. How did you become interested in beekeeping?
Well, I started beekeeping with my son, and I can't remember whether it was he who suggested it to me or the other way around. But we, for some reason, he was interested enough to come with me to a local beginner's beekeeping course to start us off. And this was very good. He didn't enjoy the course that much. He was about the youngest, I don't know, by about 30 years, really, and was frustrated by the speed of the progression and repetition required to teach a more mature audience. But he learnt a lot, and he's helped me. He went off to university, you know, and left me with the bees. But he returns, and he now lives in London. And he does come and help me with my bees every year. Has recently been married, and his wife comes along as well. So I can't really remember where that initial thought came from, but it was connected with something to do with my son.
That's nice. That's really nice. And congratulations on your son getting married.
Thank
and,
you.
May he have a very pleasant, happy, prosperous marriage.
Yes, hopefully, yes.
Now, the process of beekeeping, it sounds like, oh, it's probably not very technical or not very difficult. You know, I actually, interestingly enough, and I'm going off on a tangent here, but I was speaking to a Dr. Khan from the University of Temetry in Toronto, Canada, on one of my shows, and this was to do with cardiometabolic risks. And he said something very interesting. He said the research has shown that nowadays, the honey that we purchase from retail outlets, let's say, that honey is not as pure as we think it to be. And, you know, it can be mixed with other elements, you know, to keep it sweet. But the pure honey is available, of course, like yourself. But the onus nowadays is very much on beekeepers, and those who are after purity would, of course, find somebody local and look for honey. But it sounds easy, but it's not, is it, to actually have honey from the hive to the jar? I mean, am I right here? It's not as easy as it sounds.
Yes, the people that I've mentioned who are interested in honey very often are quite surprised by the amount of work and commitment that's required. And you do have to be very, very careful. I mean, it is in the active season, which is sort of round about from March till, say, end of September, October, it can be full on. And obviously, the more colonies you've got, the more work you have to do. And you just have to go through, work with nature, and as the seasons progress, react to what is happening in the colonies.
That's interesting because, you know, you just said March to October. And so we're looking at about 8 months. Now, I'm sure that generally when people think of beekeeping, they just think of probably not even March, certainly. They'd probably think of like April, May, June, July, and that's the end of it, you know. But 8 months is actually quite a big commitment, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's active then, and very, very busy time is at the moment the bees are almost certainly clustered in their hives, keeping warm, and they'll go out perhaps on sunny days and when the temperature rises just a little bit more. But I suspect at the moment they're not flying, and they're feeding on the stores that they've built up throughout the spring and the summer. Or sugar syrup that the beekeeper will feed them. Because if you take off the honey, if you take off too much honey, then you leave your bees with nothing to eat. And they need to get through the winter. If they don't get through the winter, you don't have the bees in the spring. Come the spring, the queen is laying more prolifically. She's responding to the length of the days and the flowers that are coming out for pollen and nectar. She doesn't get that. The workers will get that for them. And it's the time when colonies build up and there is a chance that they will swarm. From the bee's point of view, that's a very natural process, which is a reproduction of the colony. From the beekeeper's point of view, you want to try and avoid the swarms because you want to keep it onto your bees, because the bees will disappear off some of your colony will disappear off in off with the swarm, and that will affect your honey crop. So you have to do weekly checks at this point to ensure that there are no signs of the colony swarming, as well as looking for things like disease within the colony. You want to make sure that the colony isn't under threat from various mites and other organisms that will attack them.
Right. That in itself is quite. Have you ever experienced anything like that, as far as an attack, perhaps?
Well, most. I can't speak for every beekeeper, but the Varroa mite, which is the mite that most people have heard of, is probably one of the biggest threats to colonies of bees, and it is. Pretty much ubiquitous, it's everywhere. And you do have to take you have to take precautions, and you can you may have to administer medication to get rid of the mite.
Right.
At various times of the season, and also being very wary that the overwhelming majority of the medications used will taint the honey. And so you can only use it at certain times of the beekeeping season.
It sounds like a very sensitive and delicate process itself, doesn't it? One has to be very, very careful.
Yes, and I think a lot of beekeepers would prefer not to use medication, and they try and use... management techniques within the hive that don't involve it, but ultimately you have to get the mite level down to a workable level within your colony, and for most, at some point of the year, that is using a miticide.
Right. Now, what makes the queen bee the queen bee? I'm sure there's no process of election there, is there?
Yeah, there's no process of election. The queen bee is from the same egg as a worker bee. All the workers are female, and obviously the queen is female, and they start from the same egg, same type of egg, female, a fertilised egg. And it's 3 days as an egg, and then the larva hatches. And the egg of the queen is laid in a different type of cell to that of a worker. And that will tell the workers that it's a different, that it's going to be a queen. And the nurse bees who feed the larva and who feed it, the larva prolifically, will feed the queen bee differently to the worker bee, and it's that feeding that is part of the reason why that egg develops into a queen as opposed to a worker.
So this is a natural phenomena. There's no human intervention here, is there?
No human. Well, it is a natural phenomenon. That is what happens within the hives. I mean, that doesn't mean to say that some beekeepers will, by grafting or whatever means, they will produce honeybee queens. Yes, but that is a different process. I mean, it is.
Yeah.
A
process, but the natural process is a natural phenomena that just occurs to help identify the queen bee for the other workers.
Yes.
Fascinating. That's an education in itself, isn't it, to understand that process, you know? Perhaps we'll actually cover that in one of the future episodes of the show. I'm sure you'd want to know that actual process that takes place. Anyway, let's move on. I'm going off on a tangent again, and I must refrain myself. Thank you so much for so much information so far, Deborah. But I wanted to ask you here, actually, what is an average day? So let's take an average day in March at the beginning, say, of the season, and then an average day at the peak. What's involved? I mean, what do you get up to during that day?
Well, It's more an average week, really. Because what you're actually doing is you're responding to what's happening in nature. And as you know, some springs are better than others. And so and your colony is responding to this. If there's not much forage around, that is pollen and nectar, then there's no point in the queen laying prolifically, because there'll be nothing to feed the new brood, so the laying rate will reduce. However, generally speaking, in those early weeks, the beekeeper is checking to make sure that there are no checking to make sure that the colony is building up and that the queen is laying, checking for diseases. As I've mentioned, checking that the queen has got enough space to lay, and that there are enough stores, particularly in those early months, when the winter bees, which have gone through the winter, are dying off, and it's taking a while for the new nurse bees to come through. And so the colony is quite vulnerable in those early months. And so you should make sure that they've got enough food. And that could mean that you feed them sugar syrup.
Right.
Hopefully.
Is that a necessity, isn't it, I suppose, based on the current climate and situation that everything has that potential risk now, isn't it, because of climate change and the way the world is changing.
Whereas as a beekeeper, I do take honey off the hive, but I try and leave. I'm not greedy. I try and leave enough honey for the bees to go through the winter. If you take off a lot of honey and don't leave the bees with enough, then you have to feed back sugar syrup, which is literally sugar and water, to get them through the winter. Because if there are not enough stores in the colony will die. It's as simple as that. And as you know, in the winter there aren't many flowers flowering, and there's not much pollen around, and so they need pretty much the stores to go from, say, October through until February, March. So I check to make sure that the stores, that there are enough stores. So even if I've left on honey, I still have to check, because you're never absolutely certain that that you've left enough. Right. Make sure that I keep their stores topped up. In the winter months, that would be feeding them fondant, and in the at the end of the season, if you're feeding then, when the ambient temperature is reasonably warm, you can feed liquid feed, which is a syrup.
Right. You mentioned fondant. I've immediately thought of Mr. Kipling's cakes.
I think it's baker's fondant. I buy it commercially? Yes.
Yeah. So much for my diet. Obviously, yes, it's not going very well. If my mind's going towards Mr. Kipling, God bless him. Right. So, what's the sort of when does it really get busy? I mean, is it like you've mentioned?
March is a busy time. March is a very busy time, because the colonies are building up, and they can build up very fast. And you do have to make sure that they're not likely to swarm, and that's important not only for holding on to your bees, but it's important if you are, for example, an urban or a suburban beekeeper. You do not want to disturb your neighbours with swarms emanating from your colonies, so it's quite important. So that is busy, and obviously the more colonies you have, the more hives that you have to look through. So I'm looking for queen cells, which is a sign that the colony is going to swarm. I'm checking for the varroa mites, and I'm looking generally at the health position of the colony. And are there any signs that there could be something amiss?
Right. And when, or is this, this is in answer probably, it might be that it starts from March, but is there a peak where you know that there's going to be, let's say, an abundance of honey? Or is that, does it gradually build up, or does it stay, remain the same over a few months? Or
seasons, years vary. Last year, last summer for me was very, very good. I had a lot of honey, though the weather was very hot and a lot of it came through very quickly. I had a very good spring harvest because everything was early, and I don't normally have a spring harvest that's much to speak about. So that came about end of May for me. So that was quite busy. So there's a lot of nectar coming in then from the bees. So I did an extraction then. Then you just have to be careful because sometimes the flowers fall off and there's a what we would call a June gap. There aren't so many flowers in the garden before the next flush of ones come through. And for me, one of my biggest crops where I am is the brambles. So the brambles, and it's a little bit like a switch turning. Switching on, and the nectar flows into the hives and is processed into honey.
Wow, and fascinating.
That will finish where I am, and it varies in different parts of the country, but will finish sort of pretty much about the end of July. Now, there are some other flowers that provide nectar, but that's, as far as I'm concerned, is for the bees. And I will extract my honey, my summer honey, around about the end of July.
And
it does vary. And so those are very busy times. They're physically busy as well, because a hive is comprised of a brood box. Then you'll have something called a queen excluder, which is literally what it says. It stops the queen from, it confines the queen into a particular space, which is the brood box, where she lays and the brood is produced and nursed. Right. Above that, you will put something called a super, which is another box which contains frames and is where the bees will put the honey. And so at a certain point when that's full and they cap it, when they've got the water level, water content to, below about 18%, they will cap it. And that tells the beekeeper that the honey is ripe and ready to come off. And that's when I will take the bees off. And those frames, those boxes are very, very heavy. And that's when I get my son to help me, because it's quite difficult. That's hard work.
I can imagine, yeah.
And they are then brought home and extracted.
And that was Deborah Campbell, a local beekeeper in the area of Buckinghamshire. And I will have part two of my chat with Deborah in next week's show.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
And now it's time for reflection with poems of healing. This one is called Frosty Beginnings. I watched them frozen in trance, the tiny flecks beyond the glass gently trickle from the sky, floating through the frigid air, covering each thing that they brushed with soft white dew, cold to the touch. The window was like nothing I had ever seen, or felt, or heard. The snowflakes were like drops of magical rain, the kind that fell loud and fast, but frozen into icy dust, and slowed down just enough that they sauntered slowly through the clouds. The cold air felt like heat pouring from the island sun, but lessened into frozen wind and tempered down just enough. Then it sent ripples through my skin, forming goosebumps from within. The bare trees looked like the West African iroko, with leafy branches stretching out, but reduced to naked flames, and stripped down just enough that when wind travelled through their shells, no sound of rustling leaves were heard. This poem was written by Davida Iam Ozung, published in Sauti, Poems of Healing by the United Nations. I do hope you've enjoyed the Homeopathy Health Show here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio. Tune in next time for more things homeopathy, interviews and segments on the healing possibilities that homeopathy can bring you. And don't forget to visit UK Health Radio online at www.ukhealthradio.com to see the many other amazing shows available to listen live and on demand. Or why not download the app from the iOS and Android stores. Until next time, stay safe and take care.